And welcome, everyone, to The Peaceful Planet. You were listening to The Peaceful Planet with the words, as done by Chris Moores, formerly one of our show hosts. The music is being written by Bob Murray, and you can hear more of his wonderful music online at www.thestarstillshine.com. He is working with John Lennon and George Harrison in spirit. They are writing the tunes for our show. We're honored to present it to the public and have been doing so for a number of years now. And as well, I want to mention that I am also working on the lyrics with John. So anyway, we welcome you to another great show with The Peaceful Planet with your host, Marcia McMahon. We have a wonderful author today. We have PMH Atwater, who is the author of the big book of near-death experiences. We're going to have a fascinating conversation with her in just a minute or two after my announcement. And I want to draw your attention to something really unique that's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I am going to be co-leading a spiritual odyssey tour through Greece coming up in late February. We depart February 17th and we return on the 24th. We are going to explore the heart of Western civilization, the great legacy of the Greek civilization, and as well connect with the powerful energies of the archetypes of the Greek gods and goddesses, or the god within. We will be meditating at various Greek shrines, such as the Parthenon, ancient Delphi, and many other places along the way. As well, I'm an art historian. I will be giving information of a nature, of a knowledgeable nature regarding the works of art and these classic ancient works of sculpture and architecture. Also, Andrea Pinkham, the co-host of the tour, will be giving information about the mystery schools of ancient Greece and leading meditation. It's going to be phenomenal, and we want to invite our listening audience to visit the website. It is posted on the show information along with PMH Atwater's information on the link for The Peaceful Planet. But if you're listening for the first time and cannot really locate that, please visit www.bodymindspiritjourneys and then click on Sacred Journeys, and you will find Greece. We appreciate any feedback that you can give us about the Greek tour. And if you have trouble locating any of the links, please feel free to send me an email at dianaspeaks@hotmail.com. As well, I want to mention my books, which are listed on Amazon, and my website, which is www.dianaspeakstotheworld. For those of you that know me, you know that I channel Princess Diana, who has wonderful diplomatic solutions to create peace for the world at this time. And as well, I encourage you to visit the website where you can link on the art gallery and see more about my channeled portraits. So anyway, I am so honored to have a wonderful guest with us today, Dr. PMH Atwater, author of the big book of near-death experiences. And I'm going to read a section of her bio, as I usually do, to introduce her, and then we're going to talk about the big book of near-death experiences. This is going to be a fascinating, riveting interview. Do not leave your seats. Do not turn off your internet right now. You will want to hear what she has to share with you. As well, we're going to open our phone lines to speak with Dr. Atwater at 877-876-5227. Dr. Atwater was born in Twin Falls, Idaho. Atwater married young and became a mother of three, a Sunday school teacher, secretary, and prize-winning cook. A handwriting analysis in the mid-60s led to a complete career and lifestyle change. She was redirected into public service and innovative project development and analysis. Paralleling this change, she began intensive research into paranormal and altered states of consciousness. With a professional background in hypnotic past life regression, sensitivity work, de-haunting houses, and mediumship, she came to specialize in aura massage, astrology, numerology, dream and symbol interpretation, rune casting, and divinatory and earth energy sensing. 1977 set the stage for severe health traumas resulting in death and near-death phenomenon 3 times in 3 months. In the following year, in an effort to understand what happened to her and what was still happening, she began to seek out and interview other near-death survivors. Her initial findings about the after effects of near-death were published in Vital Signs magazine, 1981-85, and later became Coming Back to Life, The After Effects of a Near-Death Experience, with Valentine Books. So anyway, I would like to give a big welcome to you, Dr. Atwater. It's great, great to have you on our program.
Well, it's fun to be here.
Well, great. Your book is an absolutely fascinating read and a really good guide for all the verities of experiences that exist among both children and adults. And I think you've pretty well covered the gamut, and I can't imagine the amount of research that you've put into the big book.
Yeah, well, you know, I've been doing it since 1978. So I'm one of the original in the field. Yes, that's a lot of information, not just about my research, but about a summary of everybody else's. And what I would like to do right now to get us started is to make a big announcement, because
sure.
This is so important. I want everybody to hear it. The field of near-death studies has taken an abrupt and major shift in the last several years. It's no longer under the aegis of the Moody miracle or the myth of the light at the end of the tunnel or the religion of the resuscitated. Now, today, the near-death phenomenon is the number one choice of scientists worldwide to study consciousness itself because of 4 major clinical prospective studies done in 3 countries, plus a plethora of papers now published in peer-reviewed journals. We can say, and I hope you're hearing this, I hope everybody in your radio land is hearing this, we can now say things like out-of-body experiences, the dead come back, visitors from the other side, otherworldly journeys are normal and typical to the experience and are not in any way representative of or connected to things like oxygen deprivation, the dying brain theory, drug hallucinations, any of that. We now have the kind of research done that shows that the near-death experience is not like any of those. So we're standing now on a firmer foundation than we ever had before. Believe it or not, over 100 medical colleges and universities now teach classes on the near-death experience. One of those is the Mayo Clinic College of Medicine. They require now all their first-year students to take classes on the near-death experience.
Well, so that is a wonderful announcement.
You know, isn't that exciting?
It is wonderful because it's about time this became integrated into the medical training and the doctors themselves, and really Elizabeth Kubler-Ross opened up this whole field with her her groundbreaking books in the 60s with On Death and Dying. But, you know, prior to that, they were so resistant to even talking or touching the subject. So, you know, you have also done an extensive amount of research, and it looks like it's the equivalent of a lifelong passion of yours.
Well, my research base is over 4,000, nearly 4,000 adult and child experiences.
Interviews, yeah.
Well, not just interviewed. I study them. I'm an observer. I'm a witnesser. So, I'm a cop's kid. I was raised in a police station. And Dad started teaching me police investigative techniques at the ripe old age of 9 years old. So, you know, I grew up this way, learning to study and watch, you know, the dance we do as we walk around and move our bodies. What happens to the pupil of the eyes? Where does the weight go on the feet? What do the people do with their hands and arms and so forth and so on? So I don't just talk to people, I study them.
Well, I think that's what's so remarkable as well. Your book is beautifully written. The illustrations, and I'm an artist as well, the illustrations and the research that you did into these varieties of illustrations, such as the Hieronymus Bosch illustration, are wonderful. And so many of the drawings that you've collected from these experiences really tell it all in a very different kind of way, because I think what I'm getting from having read the book is that so much of this is experience that is almost ineffable. It's very difficult
right. To
describe in words. And I think the picture language that we get is very significant.
Right.
So anyway, I wanted to talk about some of the key points of the book. And you talk about the types of experiences, and you break them down easily so that the reader can get kind of a grasp about these into kind of four different types of experiences.
Right. This is what I've found in my own research, is that there's not just one type of experience. In other words, the classical model of the near-death experience is not classical. That profile does not hold up in broad-based research, especially with children. So when we're really looking for patterning, and that's what is so strong about the near-death experience, then what emerges is four clear patterns. And the first one I call the initial experience, and this is always brief. You know, something like one element, maybe two or three, that's all. Yet they will still display the full pattern of after effects. And when I'm talking about after effects, Marcia, I'm talking about physiological as well as psychological. So when we're talking about the initial experience, then it's things like a special voice or an encounter with the loving nothingness or the friendly dark, maybe a brief out-of-body experience, maybe a greeter of some kind. And that's all. But yet if it's intense, and most of them are, then they'll still engender that full spread of after effects.
Let's talk about the after effects for a moment, because I think they're pretty startling and phenomenal, really.
Well, yeah, they are. When we're talking about the after effects, we're not just talking about, well, people get more generous afterward, and they're kinder afterward, and they're easier to get along with, they're more charitable, changes their attitudes and their feelings. You know, it's not just that. I mean, that's just the brief kind. You know, that's what we know the most about, but yet that's not really a good spec on the after effects. When we're talking about the after effects, clearly it changes the brain and the body as well as the attitude and the behavior. When I'm talking about the physiological ones, we're recognizing now that it changes the body-mind assembly, the nervous system, the digestive system, and the skin. If I want to be more specific here, then the first things I'm going to note is the changes in your ability to handle sound, your ability to handle light, especially sunlight, things like electrical sensitivity. Many of them are no longer able to wear watches afterward. Their presence will influence anything electrical. We're talking about with adults, they tend to look younger and act younger afterward. With children, it's exactly the opposite. They tend to look older and act more mature afterward.
Hmm.
So changes in energy levels, changes. A big one is pharmaceuticals. Almost always, a near-death experiencer will lose their tolerance for pharmaceuticals. We're talking drugs here.
Yeah.
So that if you have to take drugs, either take a child's dose if you're an adult, or turn to things like complementary medicine, alternative medicine, homeopathy, this kind of thing. Those things are effective. And I'd like to share with your audience something that I just found out about yesterday. Yesterday. One of the people in my research base that had her experience in childhood, she was 10 years old and it was a drowning. Her story is in The New Children and Near-Death Experiences. That's the book that gets in depth about child experiencers. She's now a retired nurse, and she has developed lupus. And she was getting worse and worse and worse. They finally had to hospitalize her. They put her in Johns Hopkins University, Johns Hopkins Hospital. She finally began to talk about her near-death experience and that she's different since then. There was a physician there who knew about near-death experiences. So he talked, they exchanged, they talked at length, and he said, oh my gosh, I've got to get you off of the medicine you're taking. He flipped her over to another medication that was much milder. She got better almost instantly. She's now out of the hospital doing better than ever before because one doctor knew that near-death experiencers are different afterward and it affects their bodies.
That's wonderful. You know, I want to comment about these after effects because it seems to me, being a channel or a medium, I work with spirit, I have a lot of the same traits, and I have not directly had a near-death experience.
I'm glad you're talking about that.
I'm really sensitive when I'm around. Sometimes, you know, there's like a lot of electricity when I'm channeling,
yep.
And sometimes that will throw things off.
Yeah,
I don't have
like tape recorders.
I can't hear a watch or clock, but I've been on people's radio shows and had their electrical equipment fail, you know.
Yeah.
And the other thing I confirm is that I can't take medication. I take herbs, but I cannot tolerate medication.
Right.
So I have a lot of contact with the spirit realm, and it's possible that it's the same. We're talking about a similar phenomenon here because I regularly do channeling. It's part of what I do. I've been writing for 7 years now, and I can confirm the existence of an afterlife because I communicate with so many on that side. I have no problems at all with this research, but I seem to have a lot of the same traits that you're describing.
And this is what I also recognized,
sure.
Marcia.
Yeah.
What I recognized in 30 years of work. Remember the kind of things I did before I died? And I was doing, I was very, very active in the field of metaphysics and mysticism, spirituality, psychic phenomena, all that kind of stuff. Back in Idaho, I started Idaho's first nonprofit metaphysical corporation called Inner Forum, and I was working with people by the hundreds and even by the thousands for almost a decade. And so when I compare the work I'm doing now and what I'm seeing now in the near-death community with what I found in the spiritual, metaphysical, mystical community, I'm recognizing this. And that is, anyone who goes through a spiritual transformation, regardless of what causes it, I'm going to say not just a spiritual transformation. I think that's tricky to say. I'm going to say instead, anyone who goes through a transformation of consciousness, no matter how caused, if it is intense enough, they'll display the same after effects as a near-death experiencer. I no longer feel that the near-death experience is any kind of anomaly, but is rather part of the larger genre which we loosely call transformations of consciousness.
I think that's a very good conclusion that you're drawing here, and I don't have any argument with it. I think that's a logical step.
Well, what makes near-death experiences unique is that they happen to anybody of any age, even newborns. it happens anywhere in the world, regardless of, you know, race, socioeconomic status, so forth and so on, and it can be tracked through medicine or technology, or, you know, our scientists can study it. So
well,
that's what makes it unique.
Dead.
Yeah.
They do document. And, you know, you were saying in the book, too, I thought this was an intriguing point, that sometimes they would be clinically dead for more than the 3 minutes or so that we can live without oxygen, and they come back and, excuse me, they're very often not brain dead, you know.
Marcia,
so,
the average, now we're talking averages here, the average length of time without vital signs, that means not breathing, heart not beating, flatline brain.
Yeah.
So the average time without vital signs for the typical near-death experiencer, child or adult, is between 5 to 20 minutes. Now, because of what we know about the brain, and it has to have oxygen, we know the, you know, any time between 3 to 4 minutes, if you don't have enough oxygen, you come back brain damaged, if even that, 5 to 20 minutes average. Now, most of them come back with little or no brain damage. Some come back a little brain damage, but most of them do not. They come back instead brain enhanced. That is to say, they know more than they did before. And that's a signature feature of the near-death experience. That is typical and normal to the experience, especially with children. With children, we're able to see that jump in intelligence far more clearly. And I think it's a bigger jump because with the tiny ones, they're still in the process of brain development, laying out the circuitry, all that kind of, you know, development in the brain, and when they get hit by the intensity of a near-death experience, and that's what I consider the near-death experience to be. It's like a hit, or it's a force that happens, and if it's intense enough, then these kids, that's where you get the skyrocketing jumps in intelligence. It's just phenomenal. And they come back abstracting. Now, we find this with adults, too.
Mm-hmm.
But we see it so much more clearly with children. Even from the, let's say, for instance, newborns, an infant, a toddler. Once they are proficient in language, they can start talking. These kids are abstracting. Not only are they thinking outside the box, they don't even know a box was ever there to begin with. Let me give you an example of abstracting. This is one of the kids in my research base. And by the way, he's still a child when I was working with him, although he's a little bit older. This happened when he was first grader. And it's the state of Georgia. He drowned halfway through the school year. Mm. When he was able to get back into school, now, this is first grade, Marcia. Well, the books are, you know, See, Spot, Run, Dick, and Jane.
I've been in school all my life. I understand what they do at first grade.
You know, first grade. Okay. This little boy comes back reading Greek mythology, and he goes up to his teacher, and he says, why was the book Robinson Crusoe ever written? Now, that's abstracting. He's dealing with, he's thinking on the conceptual level. And so they had to pull him out of first grade and put him in a gifted program.
Mm-hmm.
This is typical. This is not unusual.
So it does something to accelerate the brain.
Right.
How it changes
physical. I truly feel it changes brain structure and function.
So. Well, getting to some of these case studies, if I may change into this for a moment, and then we can also cover the other examples. We were talking about the basic four examples, but the case study of this Mel and Thomas Benedict is fascinating, too.
He came back inventing. He was one of those that came back with specific instructions of specific items to invent. And he did. I mean, I discovered him in that sense. He was living then in Fayetteville, North Carolina, went to his home, met his mother, was around him, stayed overnight, several nights, was around him for a while. And I actually saw several of his inventions. One of them was a particular kind of glass scissors. He was making stained glass windows at the time, and, you know, there's a lot of hand fatigue with cutting glass. So he invented a particular kind of scissors where you can cut glass without hand fatigue.
Hmm.
And it was just amazing what this guy was doing. So now today, he's sharing a lot of what he was told, what he thought, his experience in a way that he's never shared before. And he's speaking to audiences all over the world, and all I can say is, go, go, go. I mean, this guy is worth listening to.
It's about time that this was brought out. But, you know, he apparently had an extraordinary vision of, it says here that he was pulled through the light, away from the tunnel, far away from Earth, past stars and galaxies.
Well, that was his choice. That was his choice.
Physical realities. To a multi-angled overview of all the worlds and all creation. I mean, it must have been just a spectacular vision. And he also had a serious disease at the time.
Brain tumor.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was dying of a brain tumor. When he came out of his experience, no tumor.
Yeah.
Gone.
Amazing.
Poof. And that happens also fairly frequently with near-death experiencers. They come back either with the disease or problem cured, or nearly so.
So there is an overall, what I would, looking at these as an outsider in, and I've had a few experiences that might qualify, but nothing where I felt that I had crossed over fully into the other side. So I can't speak of it personally. But looking at it, it seems as though some of these near-death experiences appear to be a wake-up call for the soul.
I think they all are. I think they all are. I truly feel
that. And I wonder if you could speak about some of the examples in the book that really caused life transformation. I know Mel and Thomas Benedict is a good example. There's so many other cases.
Most of them do. Most of them do. Between, I would say, like around 65 to 70% make significant changes in their life because of what they went through. So we're not just talking about Mel and Thomas, who had this incredible witnessing. And it wasn't just revelation. He was able to be there, go there, do that. So I would call it a witnessing. And the same was true in my own case. I was able to witness the inner workings of creation and consciousness. So many of us had that kind of exposure and did that kind of thing and came back then with that kind of information or reality that we were able to pass on. In my own case, you'll get a lot of that in my book, Future Memory. By the way, the book Future Memory is the only book I've ever written that is mathematically calculated on the format and the basis of a labyrinth. Every sentence, every paragraph, every page in the book is part of the math that I use to create future memory. So that when you pick up the book and start reading it, you have to go from first page to the last page. You can't skip around or read the back first, or you'll wonder why I ever wrote such a dumb book, because it won't hold up. You have to go through it like you would walk a real labyrinth. And the purpose of the book...
That's interesting, because I have a habit of reading a book from back to front.
Yeah, you can't do that with future memory. And
no,
the purpose...
I'll have to remember that, and if you want to send that on for a future show, you know, maybe we're already in the future memory, ha-ha.
Well, the purpose of the book is to bring you up to the next highest level of consciousness possible for you.
Uh-huh.
So it's like a psychotronic device.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of people come back with this. It's not just me. It's not just Mel and Thomas. There's a lot of us.
Have you seen bits of the Earth's future and what they call the ascension? Were you able to get visions of that kind of thing?
I was able to witness how it works. So I got beyond all of that and was able to see how it all works. So I got to the core issue, the center point of creation itself.
Oh, that's marvelous.
But, you know, when we're looking at the book, the big book of near-death experiences, I would urge everybody in your audience to get this book into the hospitals and into the clinics and into the churches.
I agree.
With the nurses and the educators and the parents and the experiencers. You know, what they need is in this book.
Mm-hmm.
It's
well,
all there.
What it does is it offers, I think, initially so much comfort to both the bereaved and to those that are facing death, that there is nothing to fear in death and that there is a spirit realm that we all enter. And the less fear associated with the dying process, the better off. So I couldn't agree more that people need to have this book as a reference. I think it's a wonderful reference, and you've got so much very good corroborating evidence for not just your research, but you mentioned everybody
yeah,
else
everybody.
In the field. And
everybody.
There's a wonderful index in the back, and everything is nicely organized. So that I agree, and I think it must be opening up with your announcement at the start of our talk today. It seems as though finally the medical profession is kind of being forced to open up to this because there's so much literature on the subject now and so many people describe it. I was interested, too, in the contrast between the religious right or the religious fundamentalists and these natural experiences that children often have, that adults often have, and the conflicted states once they understand that what they were being taught in a religious setting isn't necessarily the way it happens when they cross over.
Right, right. I really would urge people to get on my website, which is, you know, just pmhatwater.com, and get into the section on near-death cases. There is one of the cases in that section is about a Muslim woman who had this experience as a child, and because she did, she was stamped for death because her family, her mother and her father, were convinced then that she was possessed by the devil and that she had to be destroyed.
Oh, my God.
Just because she had a light-filled near-death experience as a child. She finally had to flee. She was from Turkey. She finally had to flee. She's now living in hiding in Germany.
Oh, my gosh. I hadn't seen that on the website. I've been on the website.
It's in the NDE cases section.
It's fast. I'll check it out. But, you know, I believe you. And I think that the treatment of women in general in some aspects of the fundamentalist expression of that of the faith of Islam is really unfortunate. But we also see a lot of fundamentalist reaction in the Christian faith to these experiences.
Right. Well, still today, pastors are being fired.
And then they get in trouble for saying that this is
yeah.
a genuine thing.
Pastors
and
are
I
being
think that your
fired
would
from
open
their
up
churches.
A lot of people. I think your book should be sent to all of the ministers and all of the Catholic,
right.
you know, priests and so on. I think there's nothing contradictory between that and religion, but I see religions a lot differently with my work as well because I've experienced the same pain and shunning that these experiencers of near-death experiences have had in that, you know, you come up with something real and genuine that's spiritually uplifting. They cannot hear it because it doesn't fit the format of their dogma. And unless they're liberal-minded, unless they're open-minded to begin with, they can overreact and become insanely dogmatic is just a way of putting it. But it's unfortunate because if children are seeing angels, what is the harm in that? You know, I cannot understand where someone would call the angels demonic. It just makes no sense to me at all.
Well, me either, but there's lots of cases of it.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it's great that you take the time that you do with some of these children that have had this experience and affirm the truth of their experience. You know, because affirming a person's experience with this, I think, is half of the battle because they're so extraordinary. And kids especially are going to be confused, especially if it conflicts with their religion, you know. Because they trust adults. They trust adults to be, to show them the parameters of truth, as it were. And, you know, unfortunately, there's a lot
so
of adults.
Let's get this book out in those hands.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you've got valid scientific and medical material.
Phone lines again for those of you in our listening audience that would like to call in and perhaps share a story about a near-death experience or ask Dr. Atwater a question about this phenomenon. Our phone in the USA is 877-876-5227. And if you're in Canada, you can call 888-810-8322. So again, we encourage your questions. Please feel free to call in and ask Dr. Atwater a question about the experience or share your experience. Hopefully we'll get some of our listeners that are curious about this topic.
I'd also like the listeners to know that half of all of the royalties paid on this book for 5 years goes to the International Association for Near-Death Studies. At the end of 5 years, they will own the book. I am very clear about this. Yes, I did the research. Yes, I did all the work. But in my mind, in my heart, I know that that book belongs to the readership. And the best way to represent that readership is through the International Clearinghouse on Near-Death Studies, which is the International Association for Near-Death Studies.
Well, that's wonderful.
So they're getting half of it.
Bless you for your contribution, and tell us more about the IN's website and what you can find there and about this IN organization.
Well, we simply call them IANDS. That's their initials. We just call it IN's. And it's www.iands.org is their website. Mm-hmm. And you're going to find out everything. You're going to get the papers. You're going to get the references, you're going to get the stories. They have a chat room. They have archives. They have everything that you will ever want to know in depth about the near-death experience. You can go to my website, too. You can also get a lot of in-depth material, even on hospitals, the kind of therapies that you might choose if you want to go to a counselor of some kind, also the kind of education. People come back. Experiencers come back absolutely hungry for knowledge. They can't get enough. So I recommend the types of schools and the types of classes that will be more conducive and more open to what they want and hunger for. So those kind of lists are also on my website. You know, I'm a great believer, Marcia, in name, address, phone number. So when I give references, I try to give as specific as I can.
And you've done a good job with all of the research. The case histories that you have in the book are really a captivating read. And you also define new words in almost every caption on every page. So there's a diversity of experiences with these near-death experiences, and different people have different visions.
Absolutely.
I wanted to touch briefly on the ones that are not so positive. Not everybody kind of goes through the tunnel, sees the light.
No way. Well, remember, the tunnel is a myth. Hardly anybody goes through it. In 1982, when Gallup poll did their first survey, there was only 9% of the people ever went through anything like a tunnel. We can take reports about the tunnel, and we can track them back to when the media sensationalized Raymond Moody's first book, Life After Life. It's like people didn't have a name. They didn't have a word to use for any kind of darkness or any kind of movement that they might have felt. So when that word, tunnel, became popular, then all of a sudden they had a word. They had something that they could use. And so since then, people have been using that, but if you ask them to draw it, if you ask them to describe it, it's not a tunnel. And so let's get beyond this idea of tunnel. But if you're looking at what we call the unpleasant or the hellish or the distressing experience, those are not at all rare. So, you know, sort of move past the idea that those are rare, because they're not. In my research base, it was 1 out of 7. In Dr. Maurice Rawlings, it was 1 out of 5. I really feel, I truly feel, that 1/3 of the accounts would be that kind. And the reason we're not hearing more about them is not because people didn't have them, but because most people are either ashamed to talk about them, are afraid to talk about them, feel embarrassed to talk about them, or for whatever reason, don't want to talk about that particular kind of experience. And I think that is so sad, because those kinds of experiences are just as important as the more heavenly kind, and are just as transforming as the more heavenly kind, or at least they can be. And so to put them in some kind of category, pushed aside, I think is very sad.
And apparently they also spur people on to transforming their lives when they
yes.
do come back.
Some of them are very transformative.
So, yeah, I think that would be terrifying to experience something like that. But it does happen, and that also needs to be validated.
Well, you know, in near-death research, the heavenly experience is just as real as the hellish experience.
Mm-hmm. So the heavenly experience has a lot of varieties, but it has some common traits. The light that people begin to see, the beings that they speak with, visions of heaven. There was a wonderful drawing by a man that was a cartoonist, and I'm looking for it in the book. But
oh, yeah, Spirit Painter. By the way, Spirit Painter's cartoons, and there's a lot of them in the book. He's part Native American.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
And I'm just so thrilled that Spirit Painter's work, his cartoons are all called Sacred Cows, are coming from the Native American perspective. And I just think that is so great. And his cartoons are just wonderful.
Yes, they are. I was really impressed with them. There's a lot of wonderful illustrations in here, to be sure. And so it makes the book an easy read. And there's just so much material here, and
yeah,
so many varieties
of
experience for every person. But there's no doubt in my mind that these experiences are real and prove that there are dimensions and worlds beyond our world that we physically can only dream of, can only experience, or can communicate with. And in my work, I do communicate with the other side and know a lot about what they do on the other side, thanks to these weekly conversations I have with Princess Diana. And apparently she has told me quite a bit about what she does on the other side. And I also channel Mother Teresa, and she and Mother, of course, crossed the same week. And she told me that she runs an orphanage on the other side with Mother Teresa, and they do a lot in working with children that transpire and go to the other side. And they are kept in this larger orphanage, and then some of the children are taken to her home. She is with Dodi, and then they adopt them out from there to various loving families. So there's all kinds of resources that are necessary on the other side as well, because the transition called death is not an easy one. So there are various stages to the crossing over and so on, beyond the near-death experiences that I've read about in your book, there's other things that I know about. A good friend of mine who used to do readings on my show passed on, and then I received a message from her shortly after her passing when I was still in grief, and she told me that she had met up with Diana, and she was now in charge of some AIDS orphans at the orphanage. So, you know, it's all part of a continuum, and I believe that life really never stops, and that we are all eternal. We all have an eternal home that is waiting for us when we do reach the crossroads of our life known as death. But at the same time, knowing that there is more for us on the other side makes my life more meaningful, knowing that I never really have to dread death the way maybe I once would have. And I think that's part of the message of your book as well.
Well, I truly feel that the biggest message from the near-death experience comes from the thousands and thousands and thousands of people who have gone through this, millions actually, but I'm going to say tens of thousands. The number one thing they say afterwards is just four words, that is repeated tens of thousands of times. And those four words are this: always there is life. Now, if you look at those four words, always there is life, then, Marcia, that means there is no such thing as an afterlife. There is no such thing as a before life. There is always life. It is a continuum that is always streaming by. Always, always, always. We just simply change forms.
Well, I go with that, but I don't want to go so far as saying there is no afterlife, because then that puts us back in the realm of the cynics and the skeptics and the naysayers.
Well, you know, always there is life. How can there be anything else but life?
Well,
it means we're always alive. It means that immortality is real.
Is a fact. Well, you know, on that note, we're going to have to conclude our interview because we are at time. And I want to reference your website and thank you for joining me in this fascinating talk.
Well, thank you.
The Big Book of Near-Death Experiences. The author is PMH Atwater. And her website is www.pmhatwater.com. And we are going to have to say goodbye for now. Thank you so much for joining us on The Peaceful Planet, and thanks to you. Also encourage you to check out my website at dianaspeakstotheworld.com. We're going to listen to The Long Road to Nepal as a closeout song for today, and we look forward to seeing everyone next week.
Bye.
Thanks again. Bye.